I really, really do wish that as a young woman, I had known a lot more about my own sexuality and that I had known a whole lot more about what the Bible says about sex. Had I known these things, it would have taken a tremendous pressure off of me.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber continue to develop a biblical theory of sexuality. It seems these days there is much confusion and disagreement about sexuality, even among Christians. Here now are Jack and Christine as they seek clarity in an often murky subject.
Last week we began a series on sexuality, a new series, and today is the second in that series on sexuality. But Jack, before we really get into the heart of the matter, I notice that you're interested in the possibility of writing a book on sexuality, and I'm wondering what really sparked your interest in this area.
Well, I've been thinking about it for years and years and years. It's difficult for me to pin down exactly why I'm interested, but I think what it comes down to is my sense that I never really had any good answers for why the sexual ethics, the ethics that is taught about sexuality in the Bible and by Christians and Christian culture, why is that the ethics that we teach? Why do we have those values? Why do we believe what we believe about sexuality? Particularly, we live in a world where the secular worldview doesn't really give any good rationale for faithfulness and monogamy and the kinds of things that we hold as valuable. So the question arises, why do we hold those values? Where do they come from? I've never really questioned that those are good values. They've always seemed intuitively just really right to me. But if ever called upon to defend the values that we hold on to, I didn't know how to do that. And so I've always been on the alert for what's the theory of sexuality? What's the view of sexuality? What's the conception of sexuality that underlies the ethics of the Bible? It seems to me critical that we come to understand that, increasingly so, as the world and the culture around us does not hold our worldview. It's not going to be, I think we've already seen the day where no longer is it automatic that people just intuitively recognize that being faithful in the context of a marriage is what sexuality is all about. So how do we teach our children when we have a culture that doesn't support those values? What do we say to them about why? Why should we be faithful? Why should we not be promiscuous and so on?
And what do we say to ourselves?
And what do we say to ourselves? Yeah, absolutely. As the pressures come and all of a sudden we have to come up with an answer for ourselves, what do we say to ourselves?
So what you're saying, Jack, is you started thinking about this a long time ago, and it was really motivated by a desire to understand why we have the ethics that we have and how to support what we're saying, both in our own lives and in the lives of our children.
Right.
We need it to make sense, not just be something that we're told to do that doesn't make sense, just a rule, but something that we can understand and get behind.
Yeah, we have to be able to say more to our kids than just, shut up, kid, this is the way it is. Well, that just doesn't fly. I think children will respond a lot more positively to, look, here's what sexuality is, here's how God designed it, here's what happens, here's what it means, and therefore this is its proper function, its proper role in our lives. That doesn't guarantee that they're going to pay attention and be obedient, but at least we've given them something to work with rather than just shut up and listen.
Something to chew on, something to think about.
Yeah.
I think this is a really good segue into what we wanted to get into today then, because we want to review the theory of sexuality. What we're really saying when we're talking about the theory of sexuality is, how should we as Christians see ourselves as sexual people? How should we behave in the world as sexual people? Is that pretty close to what you're trying to get at?
Yeah, exactly. What I'm suggesting, the bottom line of the theory that I'm proposing, is that the whole purpose of sexual intimacy between two people as God created it is to be a kind of language that our bodies speak, that inherently and intrinsically has a meaning that God has programmed our psyches to understand. We know what it means when someone has been sexually intimate with me and I have been sexually intimate with them, we understand the significance and meaning of that. Namely, what it means is, if I will give you my body, I will give you my all. I will give you everything that is mine, and I will commit my life to you forever. Well, forever's a long time, to the end of my life. That's just what sexual intimacy means. It's not something we're making up. It's not a meaning that we are imposing on sexual intimacy. It's hardwired into us that that's what sexuality means. I'm not denying that we can find some way to psychologically separate our sexuality from that meaning. We can become so callous and so we can so brutalize our own psyche and our own perspective on our sexuality that we can make it just this throwaway aspect of our being like Kleenex. We can do that, and there are human beings, I think, who do that. But they do that at a tremendous cost to their mental well-being, their spiritual well-being, their mental wholeness. They have to brutalize themselves to do it. Because I think as God delivered them into the world, there was this connection between their sexuality, their body, and sexual intimacy, and the promise of one's life to another person. I think that was just a given when we came into the world.
That's a very, very different view than the world has. The world certainly has sexuality in a different place. Sexuality is something that is to bring us pleasure. And if I get pleasure from you, that's great. If I don't get pleasure from you, I'll go to somebody else. But that's what my sexuality is wired into me for.
Right.
So when you're saying that this is just what it is, that we intuitively know about it, I don't think so. I don't think we do know that. Through mistakes, after we have an affair, for example, and then we wake up and feel badly about it or feel angry or feel rejected or feel betrayed because the other person walked away, that's an indication to us that we may read or may not read as, this is something that was important to me, it was valuable to me, it was more important than just the pleasure.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that our culture already knows that. I mean, it took me years to know it, so I don't expect a pagan secular culture to know it at all. What I'm not saying that we know that this is what our sexuality is, but what I'm saying is the actual meaning of an act of sexual intimacy, we do intuitively know what that means. And my evidence for that is what you just stated, that when we are, let's say some people, two people in a fit of passion have a moment of sexual intimacy together. They wake up the next morning and there's a stranger in their bed. They are overwhelmed by a sense of the mistake that it is, the how inappropriate it was to be so casual, how empty, how hollow it is. When the passion is gone, when the pleasure is gone, and there's nothing left, why is there a stranger in my bed? All of a sudden it becomes incredibly incongruous and inappropriate. And they sense that, they feel that, they know that intuitively, they train themselves otherwise.
Yeah. I think both. It feels invasive to have somebody else in my space. They don't belong here anymore. They only belonged there when I was in a fit of passion or I wanted to be in a highly sexually aroused state. But now I don't want to be. Now it's the next morning and it feels like it's wrong, it's inappropriate, and I kind of am awkward and want you to leave. But also, lots of people can wake up after many, many times of having done that, and it doesn't matter at all to them. I remember early on in my counseling experience, I worked with a woman who was had been a prostitute. And she had done it for a very long time and had done it for men who were quite wealthy. And she didn't talk about it with any remorse or any regret or any thought of it even being wrong. She didn't have that idea in her mind that it was right or wrong. And there's a lot of people in our culture who have trained themselves to not see sexuality as God intended us to see it. In fact, we have become morally callous, so that things that really do matter, like a lie, becomes something that isn't any big deal. But it is a big deal. It's just because we're morally calloused that we don't see that, we don't know that anymore.
What's critical to my theory is that we've got a choice to make. There's really two ways we can look at the case of the prostitute that you just mentioned. We could say, you know what, our whole attitude towards sexuality is just imposed upon us by our parents and our culture and our religion and Christianity and stuff like that. They've just sold us a bill of goods. None of that is really true. The truth is we are just animals and we can do with our sexuality whatever we want to do with it. It is just casual. It has no meaning. It has no intrinsic significance at all. And we are enlightened when we finally break the bondage of religion and parental training and the imposition of values by cultures, when we break the bonds of that and recognize the high truth that we are just animals and therefore there is no meaning to sex and we can be utterly casual about it, that's some kind of achievement in that view. Is that right? I don't think so, but I don't know what else to do to make my case other than to make an appeal. Is that really the right picture of our sexuality? Or rather, is the right picture that all those people out there who have the experience that being sexually intimate with someone is a heavy deal? It's a significant thing. It's not a trivial, insignificant matter. It's really a big deal. It's about my whole life and who I'm promising it to. And that's why I can't be casual about it and casual with it. And therefore, to come to a point where I can be casual with it is a tremendous tragedy. It's a devolution into something else other than human sexuality. Those are the two pictures, and we're going to buy one picture or the other picture. We just simply have to search our soul and decide what really is the truth about me. Is it enlightenment to be able to become casual about sex, or is that in fact a debasement of my sexuality?
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
Jack, before the break, you were trying to pose an argument about our sexuality. If we're just animals and it really has no meaning, or if we intuitively know that it has meaning to us and we need to act out of that intuition. And we also said that there's just lots of people who have just allowed it to really kind of be nothing. It's a very casual thing, like, what shirt am I going to wear this morning? So we have all those things going. You know, I'd like to pose another argument for the value of sexuality, and it really comes from my own experience. And let's go with this for a few minutes and see if it's helpful to people. And it really came out of my thinking about this program and why am I interested in the whole area of sexuality? Why do I want to talk about this? Why am I that interested? There's two reasons. One is a physical reason. And what is a sexual reason? First of all, on a physical level, as a young adolescent, as a young adult, I didn't see myself as either a male or a female. I didn't develop that sense of myself at all. I liked and I related well to men and enjoyed company with men. Not in a sexual way necessarily, but I just liked the way they worked in the world. I liked how they saw things. I liked how they talked about things. I could relate to them quite easily in that way. On the other hand, I didn't particularly think women were very valuable. I didn't like their flaunting their sexuality. I didn't like the what I saw as kind of petty concerns and always thinking about boys and always thinking about makeup. And I was around a lot of girls that were doing that. And yet I did have this sense that I liked femaleness in a way that I really couldn't define at all. But I'd say that I went into marriage being more neuter, kind of having some masculine, some feminine, and certainly that's a good balance to have both of those. But I didn't sense myself as having both necessarily. It was more like I had neither. Does that make any sense?
I think so.
So on a physical level, I entered into marriage not really having a sense of my own self as a physical person, either masculine or feminine. I was just a body going into a marriage. Also on an emotional level, I had built a lot of callousness, a lot of layers, a lot of walls up against a very vulnerable part of myself. I didn't feel safe emotionally. I didn't feel safe in the world. I didn't feel safe with people. So as a result, I had all sorts of protections so that I wouldn't have to experience my own vulnerability and did not take the risk to do that. What I took on for myself in terms of what I thought was what other people wanted, what the church wanted, what I thought would get a good, where I thought I'd get good feedback from other people. And so I didn't have a sense of my own self, my own identity, my own person, and it was walled off behind these protections. So I entered into marriage both physically and emotionally pretty not there. And so I could go into a sexual relationship without a whole lot of meaning. I was pretty callous to it. I didn't really understand it. I didn't have myself to bring to it. That happens a whole lot of times with people, that we walk into marriages one or the other with either a physical naivety or an emotional walled-offness or protectiveness. Sexuality is good in that in my marriage and in many marriages, it teaches people to have to risk a vulnerability that on an emotional level perhaps they haven't done or haven't done for many years. It penetrated through my walls. It broke through the protections over time. I had to work at it, though. I had to be very present with myself as a sexual being, which was very difficult because it required a risk. It required a vulnerability on a sexual/emotional level that I had not known before. And so as my sexual relationship advanced or grew up or matured, my emotional development had to mature, and they played off each other. They danced with each other. So as I grew emotionally, I grew sexually. As I grew sexually, I grew emotionally. That is another good reason for sexuality being a language of my innermost being that says I am committed to you, because it is exposing the very heart of me. It is, and from in my case, it uncovered the very heart of me.
Yeah. If sexual intimacy did not mean anything, if it was just a strategy for seeking pleasure, and that's all that it was, which is what our culture tends to say, then the whole idea of having to be vulnerable in order to have sexual intimacy wouldn't make any sense. And that's my point. My point is the reason that you could have an experience where in order to grow sexually, you have to grow emotionally. In order for those to even go hand in hand, there has to be a reality that the real, true meaning of sexuality has something to do with my very self, with everything that I am. And otherwise, it wouldn't be risk-taking. Otherwise, there would be no sense of vulnerability. Otherwise, I wouldn't have any kind of sense that this is a big deal, what I'm doing here. And so that kind of evidence is what I would point to as the reality that sexuality transcends the mere physiology of it. There's an emotional dimension to it. There's a spiritual dimension to it. There's a moral dimension to it. This is something that incorporates all of my humanity, and I'm saying something about my life. I'm saying something about my existence here.
And to be a sexual person in the way we're talking about is it has to be about all of me. I have to want to wake up to myself. I have to want to wake up to life. Mm-hmm. I can't just let myself, I keep using the word callous, but I can't allow myself just to be calloused and tuck my being away. There has to be a defrosting of myself.
But it's important. I understand what you're saying, and I certainly agree with it. But for the sake of the theory that I'm developing, it's important to make a point here. It's not that sexual intimacy means something only if I somehow invest myself in the act. If that were the case, then I could have two kinds of sexual experiences. I could have a sexual experience that means something with my wife, and then I could go to the prostitute and just have pleasure, and that would be okay, because I don't mean anything by that. But I do mean something in this other sexual experience. Wrong. That's not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is to give my body to another person. I don't care what else is going on. I don't care if I intend to mean anything by it. I don't care if I'm emotionally and psychologically there in love or not in love. None of that stuff makes any difference to the inherent objective meaning of the act. The inherent objective meaning of the act is, I am promising you my life if I give you my body. And it's important to make that distinction. But that doesn't in any way undermine your point. I understand it and agree with your point that we want, in a sexual relationship in the context of marriage, certainly we want to get rid of any incongruities between my emotional life, my emotional attitudes, and what the meaning of the sexual act is. We don't want to be walled off. We don't want to... If I am promising with my body, if I'm promising my life, then I should be promising the entirety of my emotional life as well. And we want to make that a reality. We need to work at that.
What you're trying to underline, Jack, is that we, as people, don't create a meaning for sexuality. And regardless of our experience, there is a meaning in sexuality. And that's the meaning is that I am committing myself to you, my spouse. I'm giving myself to you. There is nothing more intimate, more me than my genitals. Whether I want to admit it or not, whether or not I've brutalized my soul to know it or not, whether or not I feel it, that's just the case. And out of that language, when I'm in a marriage that's committed, I am working toward making that language more and more meaningful in my own experience, in my own mind, in my own emotionality, in my own psyche, and between my husband and myself.
Yeah, precisely. And I wouldn't even hesitate to call it, I work to fulfill the promise that I have made with my body.
We're bringing sexuality to a much higher ground than I ever read about it or hear about it being discussed. In my training as a counselor, I had to take a couple of classes on sexuality. And during that time, I started looking in the library and through books to find kind of a higher sense of sexuality. And maybe the books are out there, but I never really did find them, not in the Christian bookstores nor in just the secular work. Most of it talked about the technique of sexuality or what happens when people have been sexually abused or how to deal with a lack of sexual interest or sexual response. But nothing that really helped me understand what sexuality is about and how to form my behavior and my thinking.
There was a period, at least, back in the 60s and early 70s, where there were, within the context of the Christian culture, there were a number of people who were seeking this higher sense of sexuality by turning sexuality into something almost mystical. And that's overreaching. I mean, that's going way too far and saying things that are just contrary to our experience and common sense.
Can you give me an example of that?
Unfortunately, I can't remember the details, but I remember reading leaflets and pamphlets where they were talking about come to Jesus and Jesus will become this third partner in your marital union, and in particular your sexual union, that will sort of elevate your sexual experience into a spiritual experience. And, you know, it was all very vague. It's very difficult to know exactly what they were intending to say. But the general drift of it was, just like the mystic can meditate and become one with God in sexual intimacy, if Jesus is in the picture, he will transform your sexual intimacy into a union with one another, and together you will be united with God, you know, that kind of thing. Well, that is not my experience. That's not human experience. I just think that's completely fairy tale. It's fiction. This is not some kind of transcendent mystical experience. It's a meaningful experience, a very, very psychologically meaningful experience by God's own design. But it's also a very mundane human experience. There's nothing transcendent about it. There's nothing weird about it. There's nothing mystical about it. There's nothing supernatural about it. It's really, in the end, no more meaningful than me turning to my wife and saying, I love you.
Well, that sounds very meaningful to me.
Well, it's very meaningful, and I'm not denying the meaning of it, but I haven't transcended reality when I do that. You know, it's not, I haven't become united with the light above. I have not been united with the absolute love of God or something like that. You see what I'm saying?
What you're saying is it's down to earth.
Yes.
When I say I love you with my words, it's the same thing as being sexual with my husband. In both, I'm saying I love you. In both, I'm saying I'm committed to you.
Exactly.
If you've appreciated these discussions between Jack and Christine, you won't want to miss Mackenzie Study Center's upcoming spring conference in Eugene, Oregon. Jack and Christine will be joined by marriage and family therapist Larry Barber, Christine's husband, and Mackenzie Study Center teacher Nancy Scott for a conference entitled Sexuality and Relationships, A Biblical Perspective. The conference will take place on April 3rd and 4th and will feature such topics as biblical sexual ethics, loving responsibly, and dealing with our brokenness. Panel discussions and ample time for audience interaction will accompany each of four sessions. The goals of the conference are to clearly present and openly discuss the biblical foundations of sexuality, and to develop a practical picture of how to live in light of the biblical view. If you would like to know more about this unique conference and the cost to attend, please call us at 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. More information will be given at the end of the program on how you can contact Mackenzie Study Center. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
In our discussion just prior to the break, Jack, I was saying that sexuality is something that's very special, that I guess what I was meaning was something that was really a good thing, a really wonderful thing that God has given us as an expression of love between a man and a wife. You are saying, well, let's not elevate it too far. Let's not make it kind of some kind of mystical, starry-eyed thing. Let's really understand what it's about. And could you give us another example of that?
I can remember working around a college campus years ago, and there was a campaign. A campus group, Christian group, was bringing a speaker onto campus. And the theme of the conference was, and again, I don't remember their slogans, but come to Jesus and he will give you basically the maximum sex. Now, remember, we're speaking to a college campus that their whole understanding of maximum sex would be maximally pleasurable. So that was a little bit misleading to start with, but even if you were to allow them to qualify it and say, well, I don't mean, we're not talking about pleasure here, we're talking about the kind of wholeness of the marriage commitment that you can have, and sex is going to be better with Jesus. Well, I just think that's overdrawn, that's overreaching. It's not that the sexual experience itself is going to be any more or less if we understand its meaning and significance and and operate accordingly, I don't know that the sexual experience itself is going to be any better. To say that is going too far. But we are going to make much better choices, much healthier choices, both morally, spiritually, and emotionally, if we understand what it is that we're doing when we are sexually intimate with someone. That's the point. This is not about having better sex. This is about living our lives as sexual beings in the light of truth and what's real and what its true function and what its true role is. In fact, from the standpoint of sexual experience in the context of marriage, I think this is very, very important to understand what sexuality is all about, because it changes our expectations. We live in a culture that says one of the primary directives of your existence is to go out there and find pleasurable sexual experiences. We as Christians, we translate that cultural message into, well, you can't be promiscuous and you can't be adulterous. You have to have sex in the context of your marriage and only in the context of your marriage. But in the context of your marriage, the prime directive remains the same.
It better be great sex.
It better be great sex. Because if not, you're missing out in life. Because isn't that what our life is all about in the final analysis, is seeking and finding great sex? Well, if what I'm saying is right, no, that's not what our life is all about. And that's not even what sex is all about. Sex is not even about having great sex. Sex is about having it a very, very valuable tool that God has given us whereby we can promise one another our lives. It can be very quiet, not particularly passionate, gentle sex, or it can be very, very wild and passionate sex in the context of marriage, and it is no more or less meaningful either way. And it just seems to me commonsensical that that's going to be the experience of married people, is that their sexual experience is going to be varied and different. It's going to go through different seasons. There are going to be, one encounter is going to be very passionate. Another encounter is not going to be so passionate. It's going to be routine at times. All of that is okay if what I'm saying is true, if this theory of sexuality is right. That going through the different seasons and having the variety of different sexual experiences is really in the end all a part of the variety of life itself. But sex is equally meaningful however it comes. And what's important, it seems to me, is that that takes the pressure off. We don't have to live under the pressure of, boy, I have to perform sexually for my partner. No, you don't have to perform sexually, because you're saying that you love him or her just the same, whether it goes well or doesn't go well as a sexual experience.
And the world applauds. I just love what you just said. It's so freeing. You're right. It takes the pressure off. And I so wish I had somebody tell me that at the beginning of my marriage, or even 10 years ago. You too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It took both of us years to get this.
Yeah. There's so many messages through the lyrics of the songs, through the movies, that sets up all kinds of expectations about what sex should be and what it's all about. And it's really difficult to resist those messages.
Oh, yeah. Enormous expectations. As though the first day that we're married, that we're supposed to have a great, and what they mean by that is a great, very pleasurable, highly passionate, very involved sexual experience. And it's supposed to, you know, be fireworks all the time. And that's what we expect of each other. And boy, the pressure is just immense for people. And what I see a lot for people is they lose their sexual interest. For women, they just want to, they don't want to be sexual. They just rather be affectionate. There's so much pressure. There's so much push to have to be a sexual person in a particular way that they just give up. And that is very pervasive for women. And I guess I kind of want to repeat what you said just to make an emphasis of it so people will hear and be encouraged by this. You're right. Our sexual relationship with each other, our spouses, does go through a lot of different seasons. I think of the season of having children and very young children. Think about how tired I was, how much strain there was each day just to deal with the crying baby and the bottles and the diapers and the constant waking up and dealing with one or a number of children. I was very, very tired. Being a sexual person during that period of time was very difficult for me because I went to bed absolutely exhausted. And there wasn't really much way around it. I think for people who have lots of money and can afford a nanny or have a lot of time off, then they have the energy. But realistically, most of us don't have that. And so we have to deal day in and day out for years and years with little children. And it just takes all our energy. So I think we should expect in that season particularly that our sexual relationship may be much more diminished. Also, the whole idea of the whole need for privacy is very keen for people. And having small children that might wander in or not being able to make sure that you're going to have that private time or having it between 2 and 3 in the morning is just unrealistic. That is just an example of a season when our sexual experience goes through a real kind of dormant time for many people. Now, that's not for everybody, but that's certainly what happens for lots of people.
Yeah, and what men need to understand is, you know, that when they're in that season and their sexual experience is less frequent than it was and it perhaps is less passionate than it was, they're driving to work and blaring at them over the radio is this song, a woman singing in a very sensuous voice, "I want your body, I need your body, I can't get enough of your body," and various permutations of those kinds of ideas. And what happens is, the picture that's being painted for him is really a normal woman, a real woman out there would crave me. So what's wrong with my wife? What's wrong with my wife that she can't be like this woman who's sensuously singing at somebody? That's where we just have to make a decision. What do I believe? Do I believe common sense and the Bible? Or do I believe all these myths and lies and fictions that get put into our art forms in the media and broadcast to me? Which is it that I believe is true? Am I missing out? Am I somehow diminished as a human being? Is my life experience somehow diminished if I don't have a wife who just can't get enough of my body? Well, the truth is, no, you're not.
Well,
but I have to preach myself that sermon. I have to convince myself. Otherwise, I get filled with resentment and bitterness and anger toward my wife completely irrationally for no reason at all because I believed a lie.
And the lie is that I think that I am diminished because I'm not getting the pleasure that everybody says I should get.
And that everybody else out there is getting
But yeah. You ought to come sit in my counseling office and
know
that everybody out there doesn't get it.
I know. That's part of the message that we have to tell each other is, Jack, even the woman singing that song is not that person. She's not in real life. She doesn't believe any of that stuff. The lyrics were written by a man, probably. They're not written by her. She's singing what we want to hear. She's not singing out of her real life experience. And that's what we have to remind ourselves of. All of this stuff is a fiction, a mythology from beginning to end. It's not real life.
So let me go back to what you're saying, what you're trying to communicate, Jack, is that the reality is we are not getting, from the world's perspective, the kind of sex that we want often. We are diminished in that respect. We're not getting the pleasure we want. We're not getting what the songs sing we should get. We need to ask ourselves the question, is that really what sex is about? Is that really what's most important? If it is what's most important, then I am being diminished because that's really how I see life. But if life is about, if it's a schoolroom that God is leading me toward Him, leading me toward wisdom, opening my eyes to see the world in a whole different way. If that's how I see it, then sexuality becomes a part of the classroom of life.
Yes.
Where even when I'm not getting some of what I want, I'm being deprived perhaps of a heightened sexual experience during a season or maybe during my whole life. Is that taking away from the essence of where I'm going in life? I think that's what you're asking. And the answer is no. But I have to train myself, and that's the lesson that I have to preach myself that you're talking about. Where am I going? What's important? Now, that doesn't mean to say, should I just throw away a desire for a passionate sexual experience or a good or pleasure within the context of marriage in my sexual experience? No, not at all. But is that my focus? Is that where I have to pressure myself and my spouse toward? No. In my experience, pursuing God by taking the risk to be honest, by seeing myself in the way God sees me, by sharing that openly with my husband, by having interaction that really does end up having a character of forgiveness and mercy and kindness and love toward my husband, it is out of that that I have a heightened sexual experience. It is bigger. It is better. And in a way, Jack, it is very spiritual in that regard. Not in a way out there starry-eyed sense, but in a very deep and meaningful way, we are communicating to each other in a way that we couldn't 20 years ago, that I love you, I value you, I cherish you. Those words dig deep down into our soul, where before they were only on the surface of what we hoped for. Now that the reality, and they're born out of this commitment to loving each other in a way that's been hard, in a way that's taken risks, and in a way that has had to break through the walls of, penetrate through the walls of our own callousness that have protected us from emotional connection with each other, to be able to emotionally connect with each other and then express that sexually.
Yeah, Christine, I think that's well said. I agree with that completely. I think there's one thing I want to make clear about what I'm saying is I'm not suggesting that pleasure has no role or no legitimate part in sexual intimacy in the context of a marriage. It does. It certainly does. It's the strategy that a husband and a wife adopt when they have a sexual encounter. They are seeking to give one another pleasure, and it's perfectly legitimate for that to be the case. The point that I'm making is, whether or not they succeed at achieving the pleasure that they are seeking, it really doesn't in any way at all detract from the meaningfulness of the sexual intimacy that they're having.
Let me stop you for a minute, Jack, and kind of go another direction. And that's that I think one of the ways that I have been able to become more interested in sex and very much involved in it in my relationship with my husband is not through seeking pleasure, because that was something that didn't work well for me and seems to not work well for many women. What worked well for me was connecting to my husband, seeing him, being with him, wanting to love him, paying attention to him, not being bored by the sexual experience, not thinking about where I needed to drive my kids or what I'm going to make for dinner or about my job or what I'm going to wear or anything else extraneous, but that I was present with him, appreciating him, getting to know him, and sharing myself in a vulnerable way with him. And so my strategy couldn't be a seeking of pleasure, because that was just frustrating to me. It was out of, though, this other pursuits that I have experienced a great deal of sexual pleasure. I think that would be encouraging for many people to hear, that sexual pleasure can come, but it isn't necessarily coming out of the pursuit of sexual pleasure.
Okay.
I think that's easier for men. Mm-hmm. Men seem to be able to respond sexually, have the ability to experience pleasure far more easily than women, generally speaking.
Okay, that's a good point, and that's just as valid. My point is simply that whether it's to connect with my wife or husband, to seek pleasure, and I would even argue to be available even while distracted, all of those don't in any way diminish from the meaningfulness of sexual intimacy. Sexual intimacy is meaningful just because it is, regardless of which strategy at any given sexual encounter I adopt, and it really doesn't make any difference. I'm just, the point that I was making by bringing up pleasure is you know, for some people, it's so much a part of our culture that sex is about pleasure that they say, you're crazy, Jack, to deny that sex is about pleasure. That's true. It can be about pleasure as the strategy that one may or may not adopt. But it is not the meaning of sexuality. That's my point, is we have to make a distinction between its essential meaning and its essential function and its essential role as God designed it and the strategies that go into any given sexual encounter. Those are not the same thing.
Jack and Christine will be back in just a few moments. Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Jack Crabtree's Believing Without Seeing, First Reflections on Thomas. In this article, Jack argues that doubting Thomas has received a bum rap. Thomas merely demanded the same evidence of God's resurrection that the other disciples had received. Jack states, in the unfolding of the historical events, Thomas and no one else explicitly articulates what evidence he requires in order to believe. Jack goes on to say that this story highlights the extraordinary hurdle that exists for most people, for people like you and me, to come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Then he personally concludes, I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly, because it makes so much sense in the light of everything I have come to understand and know about myself, about God, and about life in general. Or you might want to read Nancy Scott's article, Making Contact with Postmodernism, in which she takes a close look at the popular movie, Contact. Nancy shows us how this film clearly reflects our culture's changing views on knowing truth. For a Christian, this is important. Christians have always maintained that truth exists and can be known with ample certainty. Nancy shows that the story of Contact is a postmodern tale about the relativity and uncertainty of truth, that all truth is only based on one's personal, subjective experience. She states, contemporary films are one of the most powerful languages articulating truth in our culture today. And Contact provides an excellent example of how effectively authors can present their worldview. Ready or not, our culture has embraced the postmodern version of reality that Contact illustrates. Again, at the end of the program, We'll give you information on how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Jack, you are spearheading some really important points today. Let me see if I can go back and review them. You are saying that a purpose for our sexuality is not primarily pleasure. That's not where we're heading. We are not either having a good sexual experience or a bad sexual experience based on how much pleasure we had. But our sexual experience was intended to be a communication between two people about their love for one another and their commitment for one another. We are saying in our sexual experience, I love you, I'm committed to you, and I will be my whole life. It just does say that, regardless if we have pleasure in it, regardless of anything else that may happen around our sexual experience, that is what it's saying.
Actually, I can illustrate the point with another one. There are some people who say the purpose of sexuality as God designed it is procreation. If that's true, then of course, any sexual encounter that does not lead to a child, or at least is not intended to lead to a child, is somehow invalid and inappropriate sexual encounter. There are some people who would say that. I would take issue with them just as strongly as those who say sex is for pleasure. No, sex is not for procreation. Procreation is an important outcome. It's an important collateral event, an important result that sometimes occurs because of sexual encounter. But it's not the reason or purpose for sexual encounter between a man and a woman. Rather, as you suggested, it's this language by which we can say to one another, I'm giving my life to you. And that, therefore, is valid whether a child results or not. It in no way is somehow suspect, morally suspect, as an act just because there are no children.
Okay, that's very clarifying. And then on a more practical level, we were saying that it really takes the pressure off our sexual experience when we see sex in this way. It isn't for some consequence, it isn't for some particular outcome. It just is to communicate to my spouse that I love you, that I'm devoted to you, that I care about you, that we're here together in life and we're going to share that life as a team together. So much pressure is taken off by that. I don't have to perform anymore.
Yes, precisely. It takes the pressure off of me to perform on the one hand, and it also helps me get my expectations of my partner in perspective so that I don't become resentful and bitter and angry that they are not performing up to the standards of that fictional woman out there or fictional man out there who worships me, adores me, and craves me. That's not real life, and as Christians of all people, we need to learn to live real life and stop living fairy tales.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 485 4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.